Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder, you know, a founder, you know, that has been through all the different steps that you can think of, okay? So we're talking about a founder that, you know, basically has gone with pivoting, with basically we're going to be talking about the future, the technology that they're in. We're going to be talking about to the transition from perhaps, you know, like autonomous vehicles to like more generative AI and a bunch of other stuff like raising money and also growing and scaling the business that I think you're all going to be very much, you know, inspired by and enjoy. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Varun Mohan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Alejandro. Glad to be on.
So originally from Sunnyvale. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Yeah, so I was born to immigrant parents, Indian immigrant parents from Sunnyvale. Went to school in the Bay Area. Did a lot of these math and computing Olympiads in high school. Actually, funny story, a lot of us at the company at Codium actually competed against each other in middle and high school. And that's how we originally knew each other. After that, went to MIT. MIT is also where a lot of us at the company sort of met each other as well. And that's where me and my co-founder worked together a lot. And then afterwards, joined a company called Nuro, which is an autonomous vehicle company. Funnily, I joined the company even before knowing what it was going to, what it was doing, because they were in stealth mode. But I just realized I wanted to work on where the future of robotics and autonomy would ultimately end up going. I was there, one of the first 15 engineers at the company, and ended up being a manager of a team running large-scale deep learning infrastructure offline. And then after that, decided, hey, I wanted to start something and actually build a product that people used at scale, and built a company that wasn't what Codium is today. It was actually a GPU virtualization company. So we actually built software to make GPU applications run significantly more efficiently. And at peak, we were managing upwards of 10,000 GPUs for a handful of companies, which actually accounted for 20% of GCP, Google Cloud Platform's GPU inference capacity in multiple data centers. And we were doing this with a team of 8 people. But in middle of 2022, we saw the advent of the transformer in these generative models, which is where the GPT started taking off. This was pre-ChatGPT. And we realized that that would usher in a brand new set of applications, but also that would mean everyone was going to run transformers. And if everyone ran this type of model architecture, we didn't see much value in being a GPU virtualization company. So we actually decided to verticalize and pivot and build a company that we see called Codium, actually.
And we'll talk about that in detail. But let's start, you know, from the beginnings, from the roots. You know, let's go back in time, you know, when you got into math. You know, what got you into math to begin with? Because I know that was a big deal. You did competitions, you know, whether it was there in high school or then going to MIT and still doing, you know, this kind of competition. So what got you to really develop that love for math?
I think the big thing is just the objectivity. It was one of those things that you just can't BS. And the fact that you can kind of like wrangle with a problem for a long time is very attractive. I'll just say like an interesting statement. In seventh grade, I made this competition called the USAMO, which is the top 250 kids in the entire nation, including high schoolers. And I took the contest, and it's a contest that is 2 days. Each day is 4.5 hours, and you have 6 problems. And the score is out of 42, and I got a 1. I got a 1 out of 42. And that's the median score. The median score is a 1. So I think there's something so beautiful about basically problem solving for a long period of time and potentially not even solving the problem. And I think that gives you a level of courage of solving hard problems. And I think that's what all of my peers really enjoyed. We liked not solving problems where we could instantly solve it in like a minute. We wanted to be able to wrangle with hard problems, and Olympiads were sort of a form factor that was conducive to that.
So you eventually, you know, graduated from MIT, and it was a really interesting transition, you know, that you did there from being an engineer to all of a sudden becoming a manager. So how was that transition for you?
Yeah, I think at the company, if I can just say something, it was pretty natural because I was so early there that I built a lot of the systems and infrastructure at the company that I naturally ended up leading people at the company. I think what I realized is my dream was not to just manage people. It was to actually like build a product that people used at massive scale. And I think the unfortunate thing is in autonomous vehicles, the timelines to actually do that were quite high. And that's because the problem is so hard. And I think because of that, I sort of wanted to do something where I could have an impact, but an impact today rather than a delayed impact where we potentially build something that would work 10 years from now.
So you actually were an employee for a bunch of time, you know, on other companies. So at what point, you know, did it become clear that it was your time to take a stab at it, you know, on your own and create your own destiny?
Yeah. So me and my co-founder, actually, Douglas and I, we've known each other since middle school. We've always wanted to start something together, but it never seemed like the right time. And I think for us, we decided to, I guess, just jump off the deep end and probably irrationally in that the idea that we originally had, we didn't completely understand why it was the best idea possible. But I would say like, you will never rationally come up with the best idea to work on after quitting your job.
So then let's talk about starting what obviously was at the time AXA Function, and obviously that would develop into a pivot, you know, which is what you guys are doing now with Codium. But how did that start? How do you guys get going, and then what happened?
Yeah, so this is the sort of interesting story here. As I was saying, we ended up building GPU virtualization software. So the idea was you could take applications that would previously run on GPUs and you could run them on computers, normal CPUs, and we would transparently offload the computations to remote machines. And we ended up being able to, I guess, optimize some workloads by a factor of 5 to 10x. So it was a big, big improvement, especially in 2021 when GPU supply was under shortage. There was shortage for many reasons during COVID. And for us, though, what we felt is, and this was the hard part, we were a team of 8 people. We were making between 2 and 3 million in revenue, and which was good. We were free cash flow positive as a company. But for me, I did not know how could we scale this thing to be 50 times bigger. And this is maybe a hallmark of the company, which is that if I or someone at the company cannot figure out how to increase the revenue by $1, we don't just hire someone to increase it by 10, which is to say we make really, really strong generalists try to solve problems. And if they can make no progress, the solution is not to hire a specialist and see if they can succeed. So this was a big thing where we never hired a sales rep. Even though the business was doing millions of dollars in revenue, we never hired a sales rep internally, which was a good decision in retrospect because it enabled us to pivot the business significantly with significantly more ease, right?
And in your guys' case, I mean, you actually raise money, you know, quite a bit of money. I mean, over $20 million for this. And then all of a sudden you realize that it's time to pull the plug and orient, you know, kind of like the path, you know, towards a different site, a different type of future that you would, you know, be living into. So what triggered that, you know, and also how was that, you know, type of conversation with some of those existing investors too?
Yeah. So I think at the time we were probably doing more revenue than a lot of companies that had raised more money, which is more of an indication of the zero interest rate phenomena environment in 2021. But I think what really flipped the switch in my head was I was looking at some of these other generative AI companies or application companies and seeing them with small teams getting to substantial amounts of revenue very quickly. And what it actually showed to me was the right comparison for us to do wasn't to compare ourselves to other ML infra or ML ops companies, but to what the best company we could be was. And I just realized we were not operating at our potential as a company. And then at that point, for us to be a worthwhile or useful sort of venture investment, we couldn't just be a company that made tens of millions in revenue. That is not a venture return, right? And I think for us, we had much larger aspirations for the company. I want this company to be making billions of dollars a year, right? And once that sort of switch triggered in our head, we had an option, right? We either die a slow but certain death, or we die with a non-trivial chance, or we succeed for a massive reward. And yes, The thing about taking the second option is we would die significantly faster in the case where we died. But we decided to go about that approach because it is never good to do the wrong thing for longer. And I think right now, if you were to ask any of our investors, did we make the right decision? I think all of them would say uniformly, this was the right call.
So then walk us through how was that, you know, communication that you guys endured with investors to make sure that everyone was up to date, that everyone was okay with the decision, and in that moment where you were like, okay, now it's time to get going.
Yeah, I think we were able to convince ourselves, both the founders at the time, like we had control of the board. We obviously have like a great conversation with our investors to make sure like, hey, this is what we will be pursuing. And here's our thought process. But ultimately, like for us, you know, if we felt in our gut this was the wrong call, like we could, if the investors told us like we have to do a thing that we believe is wrong, like the company was going to fail anyways. So I think our investors, largely speaking, did not oppose our decision to move forward in this direction.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Codeium? How are you guys making money today?
Yeah. So a little bit about Codeium. We're an AI code acceleration tool. Our purpose is to provide the most amount of leverage to developers in the world. A little bit of a backstory on the company. In the beginning of 2023, we had less than 1,000 users on the product. And now we have over 600,000 developers that use the product. We process over 100 billion tokens of code every day, which is over 10 billion lines of code every day. We're one of the top five largest generative AI apps in the world. And we actually train our own models and run them at massive scale. Ourselves. And this is where one of our massive advantages is. And currently, over 700 enterprises use the product, with over 30 Fortune 500s using the product internally. And the big reason why enterprises want to use the product is for two reasons. First of all, we support all the places where their developers are on every IDE, on every single language that the users can write. We provide self-hosting capabilities when necessary. So a lot of companies don't want to send their code outside of the company. And because we train our own models, we can deploy it entirely within their own environment. So the code never leaks, right? You can imagine for some of the largest companies, code is their most important IP. The second piece is we actually work on every source code management tool. The big competitor in this space is this product called GitHub Copilot, which is owned by Microsoft. And it's a massive product. But we don't care about if you're running things on GitHub, GitLab, Bitbucket. And there are many, many different source code management tools. And some of the largest companies actually have many source code management tools used internally. And finally, we actually give you a personalized experience, which means that we actually tailor make the suggestions to the private code that lives inside the company. And we found that actually for a lot of companies, they have noticed that their developers, their new developers onboard onto Codebases in 4 to 6 weeks instead of 4 to 6 months now with Codeium, because our system actually deeply understands the software that exists inside the company. And they're also noticing that over 45% of all software that is getting committed is generated by Codeium.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So in total, how much capital have you guys raised to date for the company?
$93 million.
So at what point do you guys realize you're turning a corner here with this new pivot? And also, how did that look like from a going from life cycle to life cycle and putting in parallel a financing cycle with newer investment, you know, to really keep things, you know, pushing along?
Yeah, so interesting fact, by the time we raised our Series B, we had barely spent our seed round. So we are not a company that, I guess, goes in and our Series B was $65 million. We're not the kind of company that goes out and spends a lot of capital unless it's actually making the business work in a material way. And we didn't try and go out, once we did the pivot, we didn't try and go out and raise capital. We actually just went out and built a product and scaled the product to, I guess, a massive number of users. And a lot of large enterprises started to use the product. Companies like Dell, right, that currently have 40,000 developers inside the company were starting to use the product. And I think the key aspect of this was we were never in a position where the only thing that would make us go from existing to not existing was the lack of existence of capital. And because of that, actually, we ended up being able to raise around fairly easily from the folks at Kleiner Perkins, who it's a very well-reputed sort of venture capital firm.
So what did you guys learn about, obviously, you know, when you're doing well like that, you know, you have a little bit more leverage when it comes to the capital raising efforts. So I guess from, you know, a perspective of really developing a very streamlined process when it comes to fundraising, what have you learned?
Yeah, so this is maybe a little bit of an anti-pattern, but in terms of our fundraise process, we've never actually done a very, very proper sort of fundraising process, largely because for different points of the business, we ended up getting preempted by folks that were particularly interested in the progress that we made and the proof points of the company. And I guess for us, the reason to really go out and want to fundraise really badly is if you believe that you will not be able to make it unless you get that amount of capital today, right? And I think for us, we have largely been good stewards of capital in a way where we are willing to invest a good deal of money to see the company work, but we don't invest millions of dollars into different aspects of the company if we can't see a clear ROI, right? And because of that, we always operate in a way where we could be cash flow positive if necessary.
And I guess, you know, here when we're talking about building the company too, if you were to go to sleep tonight, Varun, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Codeium is fully realized, what does that world look like?
I think in a world in which the vision of Codeium has been realized, developers now have 10 times the amount of leverage. That means that they can generate code 10 times faster, deploy code 10 times faster, debug, test, review, and finally actually navigate code 10 times faster. And in that world, the best thing that I envision happening is the next time NVIDIA goes out and does something very hard, they're building the X100, which is their newest chip, let's say. And that chip takes 12 months. I want the time it takes for that chip to get built to go down from 12 months to 1 month with Codeium. And I think if we are able to do that, we will capture a lot of value at that point. But the sheer amount of value we will be able to generate is going to be so massive that I think that would be the true North Star for us as a company.
So when you put the technology in parallel with that, you know, and where we are today and where it's heading, you know, where can you tell the listeners that the technology is going?
You know, I previously worked in autonomous vehicles where every year we said the next year was the year autonomous vehicles was going to ship, right? I don't know if you've seen this, but in 2015, TechCrunch said, this is going to be the year of AV. And in 2024, they are now saying, is this the year of AV, right? So that's largely because we underestimate what is possible over a long time horizon, but overestimate what is possible over a short time horizon. So I believe developers will still be writing code inside applications in the next couple of years. But I think what is going to happen is the amount of work it takes for them to write boilerplate applications, to do tasks like migrations, to do tasks like refactors is going to go down tremendously. But then for every piece of the pie, you know, what I like to quote is there's this principle in computer science called Amdahl's law. And what that says is if you take many steps of a process and you make one step faster, there's a limit to how much that makes everything faster. And I'll give you an example. In a world in which there are 100 units of time and 30 units of time is being spent writing software, if all we do is make the 30 units of time writing software 10 times faster, we only reduce the total amount of time spent from 100 to 73. This isn't a complete game changer, right? The game changer is how do you reduce the remaining 70 units by a factor of 10? And I think the way I would like to think about it is it will be a gradual process or incremental process to continue to shave down time from every single aspect of this process, right? Because even today, if you could write code instantly, The time it takes to review code will become a bottleneck. The time it takes to deploy code will become a bottleneck, right? And people are not willing to completely deploy arbitrary software that an ML or AI system generates into production without any review. We are far from that right now.
In your guys' case, you know, you have about 50 employees. And for a company like this, I mean, obviously, it's very heavy on the technical side of it. So how do you go about really getting incredible engineers? And not only getting them, which is tough, but even tougher is retaining them. You know, what does that look like in an organization like this?
I think, first of all, as a company, we want to hire people for resilience. That's a big one. And I think us having gone through the pivot is an important piece where we realize right now things are going well, but there will be low points for the company. And we don't want people that are here just because of some great vision that we promised them, that the company will always be having a great time, right? And I think what that means is we want people that are incredibly mission-oriented. That means that for them, hell or high water, they want to see this thing succeed, right? And even if that means that we have some struggles along the way, they will be around, right? Because ultimately what drives them is the vision of the company, which is providing as much leverage as possible. And I think the reason why that's really, really critical is, you know, and it's important to me also is, let's say we were building software to make tax accountants more efficient, right? That is not a vision that particularly excites me. And if the company gets hard, I'm going to lose motivation to work, right? So we look for folks that are incredibly mission-oriented, but also we look for folks with just very high sense of accountability, right? And aptitude is a non-starter, right? We have a very high technical bar at the company. It's one of the highest technical bars in all of Silicon Valley, I would say. But accountability is very important. We want people who ultimately, if something doesn't go right, their goal isn't to point the finger at someone else, right? And I think a lot of people misjudge high trust environments as very nice environments, but that's actually not true. You have a high trust environment if you have people that are very capable, that are high accountability. When you tell someone, hey, are you going to do this by X? They not only say yes, but they deliver, right? And I think we look for these characteristics, right? People with inbuilt resilience, people who are mission-oriented, and people who are high accountability. And if we see those aspects in someone, we're very excited to move forward with them.
So I guess as we've been talking about the future earlier, but I want to talk about the past and doing so with a lens of reflection. If I was to put you into a time machine and I was to bring you back in time, you know, let's say, you know, a few years when you guys were thinking about doing something here. And let's say you're able to stop that younger self, that younger Varun, and give yourself one piece of advice before launching a company. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think the only thing I would tell that younger Varun is be significantly more humble. And I think that is largely because having a company is a very humbling experience. You may be able to convince investors that your vision is good. You may be able to convince employees that your vision is good. But ultimately, the water finally settles. The company really needs to work. And there's a level of humility you need to have that milestones like fundraising don't really mean much. Milestones like building a technical product don't really mean much if the end result is not you providing value to someone. And focus ruthlessly on providing value to other people. And the rest will figure its way out. But that requires a deep amount of humility, because the first idea you're going to have when you start a company is very unlikely to be the right idea. It is incredibly unlikely that it's the right idea. And actually needing to constantly sort of change directions and assume you were wrong, right? The hardest part about a startup is you need to operate with two modes in your head. You need to be irrationally optimistic, because if you aren't irrationally optimistic, then you will do nothing, right? You will actually just say a big company is going to be able to do it, right? Because why? A big company has more people, more capital, and more distribution. So you need to be irrationally optimistic that you will be able to execute faster on an important vision. But you also need to be uncompromisingly realistic. And that requires a tremendous amount of humility and a truth-seeking nature for the company. And I think I would just give that piece of advice to myself.
I guess the other thing that comes to mind too is, I mean, obviously you are a trained engineer and you've been very heavy on the technical side of things. And now is the first time, you know, that you're encountering having a CEO role and more on the business side of the equation. I know that transition from engineer to business, you know, kind of like mindset, it's not very easy. And it's a tough bridge to cross. How have you gone about that transformation to make sure that you were able to be as effective as possible as a leader?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is I actually did sell the software even before we hired our first sales rep at the company. I don't know, once again, for Codeium, we didn't hire a sales rep until 10 Fortune 500 companies reached out to us. So we are not the kind of company that goes out and asks other people to solve our problems for us until we have a rough sense of what success looks like internally. So I had to go out and do that. I had to understand, hey, like we're running a bunch of these sales processes. How do we actually convey a message that is compelling? And what is compelling is not just talking to them about technology, right? Technology is not business value, right? How do we actually properly build champions inside companies? How do we actually, in a lot of ways, prove business value in a way that is not just hand waving, right? In a way that we can actually go to an executive and convincingly give them a vision that, hey, if we did deploy Codeium across the organization, it would give you this kind of a return, right? And you would then see this kind of productivity improvement inside the company. And I think for us, it is, in a weird way, go-to-market, as you said, our company is not a product-led growth company in a conventional sense. We are actually an enterprise sales motion company. And this is like a decision we made consciously in the early innings of the company. And we've embraced strong sort of go-to-market team internally at the company. We've hired an amazing, amazing go-to-market team. And like technology is as important as go-to-market, right? Because when you look at the success of a company, it's three things that ultimately matter, right? The first is distribution, right? And a startup naturally, when it starts, is not going to have amazing distribution compared to a large company. The second is technology. How great a product can you build? And the third is partnership. How great a partner and a go-to-market organization can you actually build? And these three pillars are what make a company succeed. And if a startup can't do the last two successfully, it will not get distribution.
I love it. Varun, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, just reach out at varun@codeium.com. That's codeium.com. We're hiring across the board on both engineering and the go-to-market team. And if any of this sounds interesting, please apply.
Amazing. Well, hey, Varun, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thanks a lot, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.